5CR, State v. Robinson, and arguing for the defendant, Mr. Robinson, is Leonard D. Kaczynski. Before you begin, when you can't hear one of the justices, would you raise your right hand? That would help us. Or your left. Or both. Because we're testing out a sound system, and we're having difficulty with it. We've just moved back to these quarters, and we're having difficulty. So you could help us if you'd raise your hand, and then drop it, just so we know whether it's being heard. And you may not hear counsel, and you can just raise your hand quickly, too, on that. Sorry to have interrupted you, Mr. Kaczynski. You may proceed.
May it please the court, this case began on May 19th of 1999 when Robert Robinson, my client, and Michael Page were at Pinky's Bar in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Page threw a guy named Norman Ellinger down when Ellinger was attempting to break up a fight in a bar. Robinson admits that he hit Ellinger and agrees that he was knocked unconscious in statement. Police Robinson denied allegations were made by some witnesses that he stomped on Mr. Ellinger's head. Ellinger was hospitalized for several days with severe brain injuries. Procedurally, this case began on June 25th of 1999 when Mr. Robinson was charged in Winnebago County Circuit Court with aggravated battery as a repeater and also recklessly endangering safety also as a repeater. He was charged as party to the crime on both of those offenses. The maximum penalty he faced at that time was a total of 27 years because of the penalty enhancers. On January 25th of 2000, Mr. Robinson entered a plea agreement and pled no contest to two counts of recklessly endangering safety. The state agreed to recommend and impose a state two-year prison term with 36 months of probation and 8 months in the county jail as a condition of probation on one of the two counts. Robinson was also not going to be given credit only if probation was revoked for 8 additional months that he had served pending the plea agreement. Further, it was agreed on the second count that the state would recommend 5 years of probation with a withheld sentence, and that 5 years, according to the term stated by Deputy District Attorney Britton, was to be consecutive to the first term of probation. Of course, as we all know, you can't have probation consecutive to another term of probation. In any event, on March 16th of 2000, Judge Bruce Schmidt sentenced Mr. Robinson to 10 years in the Wisconsin State Prison System. Mr. Robinson pursued post-conviction relief, and on June 19th of 2000, filed a post-conviction motion seeking to set aside one of the 2 5-year consecutive sentences that had been imposed by Judge Schmidt. The motion was denied, and we took appeal from the order denying post-conviction relief as well as the judgment of conviction. The Court of Appeals had briefing from both parties, but on June 20th, 2001, pursuant to a petition by the Court of Appeals, this court granted certification on the proper remedy for what was agreed to by the state, even as a double jeopardy violation for two counts of the same offense for the same underlying incident. The issue before the court that the court must decide pursuant to its order granting the certification is what the proper remedy is for this double jeopardy violation caused by a plea agreement. Is it to set aside the entire plea agreement and go back to square one with Mr. Robinson having an opportunity for a trial, or is it to set aside one of the 2 5-year sentences which Mr. Robinson requested the court do? Both of these two charges against Mr. Robinson were factually the same and legally the same, so they're duplicitous. I think that the better remedy and the appropriate remedy in this case is to set aside one of the 2 5-year sentences. I think it's important, first of all, to note that there is something known as the guilty plea waiver rule that this court's well aware of. Double jeopardy, as this court also noted.
Fade in and out, and I'm not sure why, but you do. So.
Okay. Well, we'll try to stay in there.
Okay.
Too much feedback. Except maybe questions from the court. But the state versus Hubbard indicated that double jeopardy was an exception to the guilty plea waiver rule and is not waived by a guilty plea, unlike other errors that are alleged, such as errors in a preliminary examination. similar type issues.
So, Mr. Kuczynski, if that's true and there is no problem with waiver, in other words, from a public policy standpoint, why not start over? In other words, there was an error here, double jeopardy, can't have that, state concedes it, and start over from the beginning, and so then you and your client and the state can face the same issue and go about it and not have the problem of what happened. Here it happens to be kind of easy, I think, if we adopt your rule, because there were two charges that were double jeopardy, reckless endangerment of safety, but let's say you had one, and they were both five, say one was five and one was two, and we're not looking at consecutive, we're looking at concurrent, because we're not just looking at this case on what we do in this situation. Well, then you'd have a problem with how, which one would you accept? Would you accept the three-year or would you accept the five-year? In other words, you obviously would be arguing for the three-year, not the five-year. But one size doesn't fit all if we were simply to adopt what you're saying and impose the one and vacate the other. What do you do with a different situation?
Well, Your Honor, of course, in other states, as we pointed out in our briefs, in the Jordan case from Indiana and the Burke case from Texas, have dealt with that precise issue. Both of those cases, if they involved illegal charges that were unconstitutional or duplicative under those local state rules, they set aside the shortest sentence of the two. So the person would serve the longest of the two sentences, whether it was consecutive or concurrent, in both the Jordan and the Burke cases. I think the problem is that I think double jeopardy is one of the more fundamental the fundamental rights that persons have, and that's why it's set forth as an exception to the guilty plea waiver rule. Double jeopardy is meant to protect somebody from having to go through the legal process with the same underlying conduct again and again. If we adopt the rule that's proposed by the state, Mr. Robinson, who thought he was getting a certain degree of finality with entering a plea and going to sentencing, is not going to have that finality, but it's going to process.
Well, that's not the type of double jeopardy violation that's at issue in this case, though, right?
Right.
He's not being retried for the same conduct. This is a multiplicity double jeopardy problem. So
correct.
That argument doesn't adhere here.
Well, if the court granted the state's remedy and we go back to square one, Mr. Robinson, at that point, whatever happens in the case goes through the whole legal process again.
All that does is restore the status quo. Why isn't that a good rule? The status quo that existed before the violation.
It does. I guess primarily it's a question of finality that Mr. Robinson had a right to expect, and I think the public has a right to expect. Our justice system that you only have to go through a plea and sentencing once under most circumstances.
Mr. Kuczynski, in State versus Briggs, the remedy was the remedy that's been suggested by both of the justices you've heard from previously, the idea of wiping the slate clean, restoring the situation as it existed prior to the error being made, and allowing matters to proceed from there. How do you distinguish State versus Briggs from this situation?
Your Honor, I think the problem with Briggs and Benzel is the facts of the case. Briggs involved multiple transactions that were a part of a very wide encompassing plea bargain involving a number of offenses committed by Briggs. The Benzel case, where the court simply set aside, where a tax stamp violation was set aside because it was an unconstitutional statute, and then just set it aside and went ahead with the consecutive sentence imposed on the controlled substance charge, basically involved the same underlying transaction, the possession of controlled substances, but not multiple type of offenses and incidents as exists in the Briggs case. So I think factually there's a difference between Benson and Briggs.
What's invalid here? The plea? Is the plea with regard to each of these two counts invalid?
No, the plea was properly taken. There's no problem with that. The problem is that the counts place Mr. basically provide for Robinson being punished twice for the same offense.
Well, is the plea colloquy and procedures have been adequately met in this case, apparently. But is a plea to counts which have double jeopardy problems an invalid plea? I'm just asking because for me that forms part of the analysis. What's wrong with this case?
I think it's a valid plea in that it was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And if the issue was a non-waiver, was an issue that was not subject to the guilty plea waiver rule, there might be a question with the validity of the plea.
Can a defendant legally enter a plea to that was entered in these cases?
Under the law governing the conditions for the valid entry of a guilty plea, that you know what the offense is, you know your constitutional rights involved in a potential prosecution for that offense, a defendant can do that. However, there's a substantive problem of the offense themselves being one that's not recognized by law, either because it was unconstitutional, like in the Benzel case, or in this case, it's multiplicitous because it's the same legally and factually.
Perhaps I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the plea then to charges that cannot be brought because they're unconstitutional renders the plea invalid to those charges. Maybe I'm wrong. Do you agree with me or disagree with me?
Well, I think the plea is valid to at least one of the charges. In this case, since they're identical in fact and law, there's nothing unconstitutional about this charge. I would agree in a sense that you legally shouldn't be able to enter into a plea of something that's not an offense, although in this case, both the state and the defense were apparently unaware and think double jeopardy implications of what they were doing or who wouldn't be here.
Well, let me follow up on that, if I may. The case that's originally charged did not present any double jeopardy problems, right? There was one count of aggravated battery, one count of reckless safety, no double jeopardy violation.
Correct.
The double jeopardy violation came into play when the case was amended pursuant to the plea bargain to two counts of reckless safety. Same offense, same facts, right?
Correct.
Okay. A plea bargain is sometimes thought of as a contract between the defendant and the state, right?
Correct.
Okay. Assuming that, what in the civil law is the remedy for a contract that was entered into by mutual mistake of law, which is, I think, what we have here. Everybody entered into this plea bargain on the assumption that it was valid when, in fact, it was not under double jeopardy. Both counsel, the state, the defendant, the court were operating under a mutual mistake of law in entering into this plea bargain. I think it can be fairly characterized as such. Would you concede that?
I would agree if this was strictly a contract civil case analysis, yes, rescission is a potential remedy, but there's two problems with this. First of all, is that we have a fundamental right against double jeopardy that's implicated here that is implicated by the
ordinary. Sorry, I missed that.
Sure. We have an interest in double jeopardy here that's not implicated by ordinary civil law contract terms. And second of all, only the state in a criminal case has the power to amend the charges. They consented to in this case. Without their consent, this couldn't have been done.
Well, let's take another line of cases. In those cases, you have a plea or a conviction. On appeal, one of the counts is overturned for one reason or other. And the issue then becomes whether or not there should be a resentence or whether this court can just drop the sentencing for the count that was dismissed. And sometimes the court does drop the sentence, but more often it goes back for resentencing on the theory that the trial court considered all the counts in setting forth the sentence for each count. And that if you dropped a count, that the court might not have given a particular sentence for one of the good counts, because it's kind of a package. You agree with that?
I would agree that's the sentencing.
Okay. So why isn't that the good rule to apply here, too? You've got two counts. The court gave consecutive sentences, right?
Correct.
Was it maximum on the on one count?
It was maximum on both.
Well, maximum on both counts. Okay. And it wasn't concurrent. So the judge thought that this defendant needed consecutive maximum sentence, right?
Correct.
If we do what you say, that defeats the concept of the judge's sentencing.
It would, Your Honor, in a case involving where you have multiple surviving counts, as it were. In this case, there's just one count surviving. He got maxed out.
I know, but that's the whole point. If you go back, if he is now charged with two offenses, the judge can increase the sentence over the maximum for one offense, right?
Correct.
Which obviously was the intent of this judge.
Yes.
Therefore, it seems to me if you follow the doctrine in those sentencing cases, that you've got a sentence here that is not what the judge intended, and that there's an opportunity to sentence what the judge didn't intend, an opportunity, by going back to the original counts. Why shouldn't we do that?
Well, I think that causes a problem in that you're penalizing somebody like Mr. Robinson for appealing and, in effect, infringing upon his right to due process. If the defendants know that when they appeal cases like this, they run the risk of going back to court, having original charges reinstated, and possibly facing more time, there's going to be less diligence on the part of defendants in calling constitutional violations like this to the court's attention.
Counsel Hall, just so I read, he got 2 5-year consecutive. So you're saying by appealing, he's risking more by going back and getting. In other words, what you would like is to have that sentence, you'll just have the one. And so he has benefited. You're saying he doesn't want to take any risk.
This defendant, I think defendants generally don't want to roll the dice and risk possibly getting more time.
Isn't there
this was a one-way street up here. It was either to stay the same or get less, not to go back.
Right. I mean, no defendant wants to run the risk that he's going to get potentially 21 years.
I thought there was a rule, a procedural rule, that when a case is sent back for resentencing under this, that cannot happen.
There has to be some type of objective factor that the trial court has to justify some type of increase. That possibly could be that there isn't a plea anymore, the case ends up going to trial. It takes as little as that. I mean, there could be, of course, other things like prisoner's conduct. But that's something I think that would be undesirable to place defendants at risk when they call important constitutional violations like this to the legal system.
Mr. Kaczynski, suppose the circuit court had imposed the sentence contemplated by the plea bargain. Would the defendant attempting to uphold the plea bargain at that point?
The defendant probably would not have appealed, Your Honor.
Would the state have any standing to say, oh, goodness, there's double jeopardy here. This is an invalid plea.
I think judicial estoppel would prevent the state from appealing under those circumstances, since they're the ones that amended the charge pursuant to the agreement.
Why is it the state can't react to an invalid plea, but the defendant can?
The state state can react to invalid pleas or invalid sentences under certain circumstances if there's violation, for example, statutory minimum. And in fact, they have appealed such cases, of course, and have come from this in front of this in the Court of Appeals. I think in this case, though, it involves the fundamental right, the Bill of Rights for the double jeopardy, and a person having to go through the legal system twice, that I think should give Robinson some consideration.
Did you suggest that the plea was defective in two regards? One about consecutive probation being the second? Is that correct?
That was correct. It was. I went back over the plea hearing transcript last night. I noticed that Deputy District Attorney Gritton, when he recited the bargain, indicated that was consecutive probation, although that was different than what was stated on the plea questionnaire and was different than what's sentencing itself. The state recommended 5 years of probation. So it'd be our position that Mr. Robinson did get some benefit from this plea agreement by reducing his exposure from 27 years to 10 years, but he certainly did not get the benefit of the state's recommendation in this case, which had been for a 2-year imposed state prisons term and probation. The state, I think, comes before this court having gotten a lot more punishment from Mr. Robinson than it ever asked for the trial court. And I think that the remedy proposed by Mr. Robinson of reducing his sentence from 10 years to 5 would be an appropriate resolution.
Is there anything to stop the state? Let's assume that you lose. The state goes back and reinstitutes the initial charges, the plea bargain, and then gets convictions. And I don't know what the maximum sentence is, but let's just assume it's 20 years. Is there anything to stop them, any kind of estoppel argument that can be made?
If the court was to rule that way and the case went back to be further proceedings of that nature in the trial court, in effect, the court would have held that the plea agreement was rescinded because it was invalid. Nothing would stop the state.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kloss, Assistant Attorney General Kloss, representing the state of Wisconsin.
To please the court, I think I'd initially like to address a question that has been raised here this morning concerning the validity of the plea that was entered pursuant to the plea agreement in this case. As I understand the law, the plea here was voidable because the law says that a defendant could enter a plea to two counts that contravene double jeopardy if there is an express waiver on the record at the time the plea is entered. And I discuss that case at page 6 of my brief. It's State versus Hubbard. So if that's a correct statement of the law, that means that the plea here has a defect and is voidable. But unless the plaintiff or the petitioner defendant raises the issue and tries to avoid the plea agreement, the plea agreement would stand. Or alternatively, if a defendant believed that it was in his best interest to enter a plea agreement and reduce charges, even though there was on the face of the information, a double jeopardy problem, under the law, he could legally do so. But he would have to make an express waiver of the double jeopardy claim on the record as part of the plea agreement. The problem in this case, of course, is apparently none of the parties really addressed the potential double jeopardy problem that was here. And they entered into and the court accepted what was believed to be a perfectly valid plea agreement and plea to two counts of recklessly endangering safety. I think the problem occurred in this case is when the trial court ordered a pre-sentence report, which came back very unfavorable to the defendant in this case, and the pre-sentence writer recommended that under the plea, the defendant received the maximum sentence. The trial court at the sentencing hearing followed the recommendation and imposed a maximum of 10 years. And I think following the sentence in this case, and in post-conviction proceedings, successor counsel saw an opportunity to perhaps reduce the sentence here by raising the double jeopardy issue. But it seems to me, and it's a position of the state, that if the defendant seizes that opportunity, takes that opportunity to void the plea agreement, then the proper remedy is not simply to throw out one of the counts, but to reinstate the original information. Because at the time of the plea agreement in this case, the district attorney agreed to amend the information, reduce the charges, and make a favorable sentence recommendation because of the defendant's willingness to enter a plea. If that is voided now by the defendant at his discretion, then I think the remedy is to return to the original information. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Claus, I'm wondering, maybe remedy isn't the issue here so much as whether either of these pleas, there were two pleas, right? Plea of guilty to count one, plea of guilty to count two.
Correct, Your Honor.
Whether either of these pleas was valid. So you say that the plea, that the charge was violative of double jeopardy. Which charge? Count one or count two? Or both?
Very good question, Your Honor. I would say both, because they were entered at the same time in the part of the same plea agreement.
You got no authority for that.
I have no authority for that, Your Honor. I'm just trying to respond to your question.
Right. I don't know the answer to it.
Right. Go ahead, Your Honor.
And indeed, that's the fundamental difference in terms of the case here. You say that both are invalid, and your opposing counsel says only one is invalid. That's what it boils down to. So how are you going to persuade us that both are invalid?
Well, they're invalid because they violate double jeopardy protections.
Only one of them violated it, didn't they?
Well, there was never a situation where one... There's never an information filed in this case.
I mean, count one standing alone, if he pled guilty to that and nothing else,
right,
there's no problem.
That is correct.
What creates the problem is count two, which is completely identical to count one.
That is correct. And the amended information in this case, I think what we have to do is look upon what is the basis for the plea agreement. What did the trial judge accept in terms of the pleas in this case? The amended information that's filed pursuant to the plea agreement is an amended information which charges two counts of reckless endangerment. The trial court accepted a plea to two counts. So I don't think, although Your Honor correctly points out, I don't have any case law to specifically identify and address this issue, it seems to me that that is the situation that's before the court. Because that's the plea agreement, that's the information, and that's what the trial court accepted, a plea to two counts of recklessly endangering.
Well,
Well,
and in the absence of an express waiver by the defendant, he has the option to void it. But he voids the plea agreement.
And that's the point, rather than whether each of the pleas is void. The plea agreement is void because the deal was two charges.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Two pleas, sentences on two charges.
That's correct.
Now, the defendant wants to change the plea agreement. One charge, one plea, one sentence.
And it is his option to void it. But I think he voids the whole plea agreement. That's our position.
And that's your position.
That's our position.
That's why you answered too.
That is correct.
What about State versus Hall? With the drug stamp tax. And there, I can't remember all the facts, but let me say, hypothetically, because I think it's correct, there were a couple of charges, and one kind of tag along is this tax for drugs, that charge. And lo and behold, the Supreme Court rules that unconstitutional. Now, let's say in State versus Hall that there was a plea agreement to the two charges, the bigger charge and then this tax for drugs charge. What was the remedy there? As I recall, the remedy, you just dropped the unconstitutional one and kept the other one in play. Correct me if I'm wrong with regard to State versus Hall, and if I'm right, then distinguish State versus Hall as to whether or not there should be two or one.
I believe your description of the facts are accurate. In that situation, there was, because the statute, in this case the tax stamp statute, was unconstitutional, and the court applied that to the facts of the case, there was no original information to go back to because the statute's unconstitutional. It could not possibly be charged. In that particular circumstance, I don't see what other remedy would be there. Because if the statute's unconstitutional, there's nothing the court remanded it. The state had no option. They couldn't come back into the court and say the plea agreement's been voided.
But
we're going to charge because the statute's unconstitutional.
The chief asked questions earlier which elicited kind of a public policy response. And the tenor, as I understood, of the exchange was, look, there's a sentencing scheme, if you will, that a judge employs when a judge is sentencing on multiple counts. And now I'm adding to it. They can be consecutive, they can be concurrent, and maybe the judge would give, if it stood alone, more to this sentence. But now that there's a couple of sentences, the judge will reduce that level but make the other one consecutive to it. So when the judge enters a sentence on several charges, there is a scheme, a plan. And if you pull out one part of that, the whole plan is undermined, or at least put into question. I mean, that was the tenor, as I understood, of the exchange. But what about State versus Hall?
I think, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that's a separate question with respect to whether or not this court should allow a sentence to stand where one or more charges have been reversed on appeal. I don't think that's the exact issue that I'm addressing in my brief, and that is whether the defendant has the option to raise the double jeopardy issue and to invalidate a plea, whether there the remedy should be reinstatement of the original information so the parties are back and can negotiate, if they so choose, a plea agreement that does not create a double jeopardy problem. I think the sentencing issue is a separate issue, and I think Chief Justice indicated that the Supreme Court is kind of on a case-by-case basis going in both directions, sometimes allowed or sometimes remanded the case to allow the trial court to sentence again, or simply dropped a charge or a conviction that they found unconstitutional. But that's a little bit different than the issue of invalidating a plea agreement. And I guess the position of the state is, if the defendant chooses the option of invalidating the plea agreement because he says, wait, there's a double jeopardy issue created, then the position of the state is that the proper remedy and the fairest remedy is to reinstate the original information. Because everything that happened in this case, the filing of the amended information, the entries of the pleas, the acceptance of the plea by the court, is conditioned on that. And if that's taken away, as this court indicated in Briggs, then the proper remedy is to reinstate the parties to their original position, which
is... Isn't your opposing counsel saying, hey, I don't want to invalidate the plea agreement. I just want to invalidate one plea. Let the rest stand. It's just the one.
That is the position of the defendant, correct. That's the position the defendant is attempting to take is, I want to keep the plea intact. I want to take advantage of the concessions made by the state, the reduction in exposure and everything else that happened. I want to keep the plea intact. I just want to chop away part of it. I want the additional windfall here of having a 5-year sentence taken away.
Mr. Kloss, if you prevail and the case goes back to trial, on both counts, with the repeaters, what's the maximum sentence that could be imposed?
According to the original complaint information, I believe it's 27 years with the repeater. With the repeater allegation, it's a total of 27 years.
There's no way the defendant can prevent the maximum sentence being imposed.
I cannot think of any legal impediment. If the plea agreement is voided at his option and the parties are placed in their original position and the case goes to trial, it seems to me that's exactly the position both parties would be in. Now, I haven't really considered this that particular issue or done any research on it. I'm just responding off the top of my head, but it seems to me that that would be a reasonable response. The parties would be back to their original position in this case.
Well, they can renegotiate another plea agreement, right?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Perhaps limiting his exposure to that which he had under the original plea agreement with another...
Right. I think Justice Krauser was just suggesting a worst-case scenario. I don't really anticipate that anything of that nature would be the result of the case if we went back and the original information was reinstated. But it's a possibility. I mean, that would be the exposure because the complaint and the original information charged those two counts. They had repeater allegations. They're valid charging documents. That would be the position of the parties at the starting point in this case.
Is there anything unfair about that?
I can't think of anything unfair about that. Because it's the defendant. The defendant is the one in post-conviction proceedings has decided that let's void the plea agreement. It violates double jeopardy. He could have, if he perceived this problem, originally, expressly waived that through the law. And the plea agreement, pleas, and the sentences would have been legal and valid. But he's opted, because I think of the sentence he received, to attempt to void the plea agreement.
So you are, what I'm hearing is that you're arguing for a very narrow rule of law that says when a defendant by his actions invalidates a plea agreement, we go back to square one. Plea agreement, you're limiting this solely to plea agreements and distinguishing it, I take it therefore, from Hall in that regard, because in Hall the defendant was not challenging a plea agreement. He was challenging the constitutionality of a statute.
That is correct. And I think if you take a look at the cases in our brief, the state's brief, that we rely upon, Pohlhammer for Higgs and so forth, where this court and this court of appeals provided the relief of reinstatement of the original information involved plea agreements. And so therefore, in addressing this case, which also involves a plea agreement, the state is asking this court to fashion the identical remedy. And that is that the original information should be reinstated and the party should be back to square one.
Let me suggest another possible solution. See what you think of it. I mean, here's Mr. Robinson, who's taken the bull by the horns, and he's identified a good legal issue. And by so doing, at least from his perspective, we're putting him in grave jeopardy of 27 years instead of the 4 or 5 that he's got left to serve. What about not applying this to Mr. Robinson? That we did, in other words, that we take this case and you win with your narrow rule of law. And we say in the future, any defendant that challenges a plea agreement has to live with that and goes back to square one, but not in this case. And just give Mr. Robinson what he wants here.
You're asking my opinion about that?
Yeah, well, what's...
How I feel?
Yeah.
I don't really, to be frank, Your Honor, I don't think, since I'm not the prosecutor in the case and I'm not the trial judge who fashioned this sentence, I'm really not in a position to say that would be appropriate in this particular case, this particular defendant. I mean, obviously, this court in other cases has made rulings that are prospective. They felt that justice would be best served, and I would agree with that. That's an option for the court. But in terms of making a judgment as to this particular defendant, I think I have to rely upon the sentencing decision that was made by the trial court here based on a very thorough pre-sentence report concerning the character and the violence of this crime. So while I recognize that as an option, I really don't feel that I can really give my opinion as to whether or not that's appropriate in this particular case.
You know, the argument is raised by defense counsel that, theoretically anyway, this court does, you know, pay some respect to the prevailing party. And if the prevailing party has identified an issue of law, and et cetera, we... So just as a general proposition, do you agree with that? That the prevailing party should get the benefit and not get, at least, not get slapped with the potential of 27 years? Well, let's take it away from this case. Not get slapped with the potential for being subjected to even greater punishment than under the initial.
If that's a legitimate concern of the court, and in terms of the real world, I don't think that is a concern. But
defendant is not the prevailing party under Justice Babbage's scenario. Defendant just raised an issue here.
That's correct. I mean, the precise issue that was certified from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court is remedy. So, if the court agrees with the position of the state, in this court at least, the state would be the prevailing party. But I understand Justice Babbage's concerns and recognize that that's an option, that this court can make a ruling perspective. I just don't want to express my opinion as to whether or not it's appropriate in this case. I'll rely upon the sentencing decision made by the trial court.
Class, as I understand the position of both counsel, if the exact same plea had been agreed to, the plea bargain had been agreed to, and the defendant didn't complain about it, we wouldn't be here if we just go forward. Is that right?
That would be my understanding.
No.
I think it's voidable, but it has to be raised. Well, if he says nothing, the plea would stand.
Let me suggest a hypothetical in which the defendant goes along with the plea bargain, whether it's the lower sentence or the higher sentence, for a while. And then the state's key witnesses are both killed in an automobile accident. Then you say, hey, this is double jeopardy. And remember that case, the Robinson case? It voids the whole thing. What would be your position then? Would you want to say, hey, let's reconsider this. Let's keep at least one of these convictions.
I've actually thought about that question. I think it's it's actually, I think, the scenario that was presented to the Indiana Supreme Court in Jordan, where 10 years afterwards, 10 years after the event, the issue is raised, the Supreme Court finds that one of them is duplicitous, I think. Well, I don't remember, there was a homicide charge involved. The court found one of them was duplicitous and said they exercised their discretion there. There was an argument about what the appropriate remedy was. And the court says, in that circumstance, the passage of time and the fact that the state's case, even as to one count, having invalidated the second, might be put in jeopardy, the court exercises their discretion and says, we're just going to allow that one count to stand.
Indeed, that's what you set forth on page 10 of your brief. And it sounded to me, at least from, I haven't read the case, but from your quoted excerpt, that the decision of the Indiana court wasn't one necessarily based on legal precedent. Said, well, we got the wisest thing to do here. In fact, that's the words I think that they used. We believe it to be wisest that if you got a 10-year-old felony murder and the state might have problems with evidence, we're going to at least let one of these convictions stay rather than invalidating both. Now, to the extent that your quoted excerpt captures the essence of the case, that seems distinguishable. Defendant here is using that case, but it seems to me that the rationale is, just as I said, based on we don't want this defendant to get away, this is the wisest thing to do. Does this quote on page 10 capture the essence of the holding?
Of that particular case? I think it does. I think it does correctly, Your Honor. I think when you get in that type of situation where there's been a significant passage of time and the possibility that the state's case may deteriorate, I think one of the issues I raised in my brief becomes very significant, and that's the issue of estoppel, judicial estoppel specifically. Because as I pointed out, you know, this is a situation where a defendant has taken inconsistent positions. And if you had a situation that was suggested by Justice Prosser, where there's been a significant period of time and the defendant has waited until the state's case is gone and now raises a double jeopardy issue, I think it would not be unreasonable for the court to apply judicial estoppel and say, no, it's too late. Not in these circumstances.
Aren't there procedural bars that would prevent that from occurring in the first place? Escalona? I mean, isn't it the rule that you've got to bring your post-conviction arguments?
I suppose it's obviously Escalona would be a bar. But I suppose in a certain circumstance, certain case, the defendant could argue that he received ineffective assistance of counsel originally and on direct appeal, And if successful, it's possible he could raise the issue. But yes, there would be a procedural bar he'd have to overcome. But I'm saying, I guess I'm assuming the worst case scenario for the state. My time is running out, I notice here. But worst case scenario for the state, overcome the procedural bar, then how would the state and how would the court address this issue? Because it is factually a different issue. And I think in that circumstance, it's appropriate for the court to look at judicial estoppel and to see whether or not the double jeopardy claim should be raised in such a circumstance. And if it is, how the court should handle it.
Do you have any knowledge about whether the state still has its witnesses and could try this case?
I do. I do, Your Honor. I mean, that's one of the first things I did. I talked to the prosecutor before we proceeded on the appeal. Correct.
And the answer to that question?
And the answer is yes. If there aren't any further questions, the state would rest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kloss. Mr. Kaczynski, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I think still this case, I think there's some important distinctions and arguments that have been noted regarding the distinction between an invalid plea and an invalid plea agreement. The state seems to take the position it was an invalid plea agreement and we should go back to state to stage one, and tries to assure the court that it's just highly unlikely, although legally possible, that Mr. Robinson is not going to get a 27-year sentence. Because as Justice Sykes points out, they could always work out a new plea agreement. There's no assurance whatsoever that this is going to happen if this case is remanded by the court. This court simply sets aside the entire plea agreement and tells everyone to start over, and this time you reach the plea agreement, make sure that it's legally sufficient. Mr. Robinson's, under the state's argument, is undergoing considerable risk that someone that raises a valid constitutional issue like this should not have to undergo. And if that is the result of this case, future defendants will be much, much less likely to raise such issue.
Counsel,
yes.
That argument, and I say this with exaggeration for emphasis, that argument makes it sound like you're an applicant for the good government award. You know, you realize there's lots of risk, but you're going to bring to the attention of the court this violation of double jeopardy, and you don't want to be penalized. And that's one way of approaching the case. Another way of approaching the case is, because that's an equity sort of argument. Another way of approaching the case is you entered into an agreement and, wow, you got a much more severe sentence than you ever anticipated. So the question is, do you raise the issue now, therefore subjecting yourself to a potential higher or lower sentence? And so you sit in your prison cell and think, well, what should I do? What are the odds? Is it worth rolling the dice? And so which way should we view you if you're arguing equity?
I think if we're looking at a question of equity, you also need to consider what the promises and recommendations were at the time of Mr. Robinson's sentence, which was a state recommendation for 2 years imposed in state and set on one count, the sentence withheld on the other. Mr. Robinson knew, of course, that none of those promises are binding upon the court, but had some expectation that perhaps that type of recommendation from the state was going to do him some good. It apparently didn't do any good after the pre-sentence investigation was ordered and the judgment read it and concurred with it in terms of his sentence policy. So I think we need to look at the effect this is going to have on future litigants, that they should be encouraged to bring certain types of violations, especially involving fundamental rights, to this court's attention, without the risk of going back and getting your sentence perhaps increased by a factor of 2.7 over what you got originally, which is about five times more than you expected. So that's what I think the court needs to consider, and that might perhaps the suggestion that there be sunbursting in this case might be appropriate. I think basically it comes down to the fact that other courts, although the circumstances are somewhat different, for example, Jordan with those facts, when they've dealt with having illegal charges on one count and legal ones on the other, have quite often voided the shortest sentence. And simply not force the defendant to go through the process a second time. And I think that's, again, this case perhaps today, perhaps all witnesses are available, there could be a retrial without a lot of difficulty, but who knows the situation 30 days from now or a year from now. I think for the court to make a decision based on that type of speculation as to what the future would hold if this case is retried would be inappropriate. We'd ask the court again to find that one of the two pleas was invalid and validate that particular plea and permit the 1 5-year sentence to stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kitchensee. Thank you, Mr. Kloss. That concludes our hearing in 00-.